Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
We're going to start today with a troubling story. It's something that's been brewing for a while now, but it certainly is something that I think should cause all of us some real concern. And this stems from protests that were on Capitol Hill, on Parliament Hill on the weekend. And they were protests, in many cases, cheering on what happened with Hamas on October 7. And that's not me paraphrasing. That is what was being said. Long live October 7th. Long live the resistance. Long live the Intifada. October 7 is proof we are almost free, is what some of the things were that were being chanted. Now, this is not something that nobody saw, because even the Prime Minister put out a tweet today saying there is a difference between peaceful protest and hateful intimidation. It is unconscionable to glorify the anti-Semitic violence and murder perpetrated by Hamas on October 7th. This rhetoric has no place in Canada. None. That was what the Prime Minister said. So this is not something that no one has noticed or that was done in a pathway in the background that was out of sight and only one person heard it. This was very public, very loud, very noticeable. I want to bring in Dr. Robert Hewish. He's associate professor with the Department of International Development Studies at Dalhousie University. Doctor, thanks for doing this today.
Hi, Scott. Good to be back.
So I applaud the Prime Minister for putting out this tweet. I think he said what needed to be said in this tweet and said that there is no place for this. But what I don't get then is, well, what's being done about it? Because it seems like nothing.
Right. Yeah, this is one that's going to have to get looked into at a deeper level. And who is going to be tasked with doing that will actually be the Ottawa police and Capitol Hill police. Because if what was said today is interpreted as hate speech, which I believe we can say that it is, then that is going to be open for our law enforcement community to actually go and investigate what was happening there and if there's some criminal element behind it or not. And what the Prime Minister said in his tweet today is correct. There's no place for that in Canada. And it's something that we cannot, as a country, conflate the idea of hate speech as freedom of expression, right? The Charter of Rights and Freedoms does not allow you to use use hate speech as a form of free expression. You can't do it. And if you do it, there's consequences for it, because you cannot propagate the intentional harm or systematic demise of another group of people in order to express your political belief. So the rhetoric that we're hearing from that protest today about praising the attacks of Hamas on Israel do qualify into that bracket. And more to the point, I mean, there's a wide rainbow of demonstrations and protests and peace movements that have long existed in Palestine and in Gaza and have emerged since the war has broken out. And what we're hearing in this one fine stripe is basically parroting the messaging from Hamas. And Hamas is one who organized the attacks on October 7th. And they're the ones who are of several groups that are steadfast in their agenda, which is the eradication of Israel. And this is what needs to be investigated, because if there was some sort of criminality behind it, let's go see where it leads. If it was really poor messaging on part of the protesters there, then that needs to be called out, because there's all sorts of peaceful protesters who are in disagreement with what's going on in Israel and in Gaza, but they're not going to that level of carrying that message.
What I don't understand about this, and again, I applaud the Prime Minister for taking the position on Twitter that he has. I think it's the appropriate way to address this. As you said, I hope there's more, but there were police at this rally, like there are at any kind of big protest like this. There are police there. I don't understand it. Like, I fully believe, and maybe I'm wrong on this one, but I really believe that if someone was chanting at a rally for, you know, a white rally, if great for killing George Floyd, somebody would be arrested on the spot for doing that. What I don't understand is why police wouldn't be doing something without having to have government intervention to say, you got to do something, guys.
That's a good point, right? There's some actions that would warrant an immediate police response for their activities, especially if there was that sort of extreme hatred being projected. Now, what I'm guessing is the case here is that when police are on, public safety for a protest or a demonstration, it's tricky because you are trying to balance the Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which does allow and does encourage assembled peaceful protest, but you're also trying to uphold the Police Act, right? And so when you have these situations where protesters come out and you have police present and the protesters go far beyond where they should be, you're getting a lifetime constitutional battle between two very important acts and legislatures within Canadian society. So in some cases, police just kind of let it ride out and say that for public safety, we're not going to, instigate arrests or detentions in that sense. But the long-term effects of this will still be able to be carried out. When you're participating in rallies like this and there's a police presence, you betcha there's photographs, there's records, there's evidence. And that can be drummed up, looked over, analyzed, ran through different databases and persecuted after that if need be.
I don't want to conflate the two because it's too easy to do this. But I mean, oftentimes people will point back to the trucker protest that was on Parliament Hill. And I understand it's a different circumstance. But there are a lot of people who are now pointing, saying, look, the government was very outspoken about what was happening there. Saw that as a huge threat. The Prime Minister was in hiding basically for part of that thing. And this, it seems as though it's being handled with a different sense of sensitivity. Do you get that same feeling, or are these so far apart that there's not even a reason to mention the two in the same breath?
They are kind of different animals in the sense that you had one event today that was occupying a public space that's meant for demonstrations or rallies or sometimes celebrations. That's the design of that front area, I guess what you would call it, the quadrangle of the Parliament Hill is for that. With the truckers, that was a massive occupation of urban space that had lots of concerns for public safety that were going far beyond the message being carried. Now, similar tactics can be said. We see that happen in France, Belgium, when industry workers will go out and dump milk or ride their tractors through Paris or that kind of stuff. But there's usually an exit strategy at the end of the day for that. And I think that when there was really no exit strategy for the truckers, and when it was mounting that there was more and more public safety concerns stemming from this tension, that it does put it in a bit of a different category, I reckon.
Yeah, the one thing, though, where it gets complicated is the truckers clearly, as you very correctly say, were an occupation for a long time. This isn't an occupation in the same sense, but it seems like it is happening every day. So they're not honking horns and they're leaving at night, but it's again the same day and some of the things being said. It's really tricky, and I think the government, we only have 30 seconds here, but I think the government put itself into a bit of a tight spot when the trucker thing happened with the way it reacted, because it's going to be the natural reaction of what are you going to do with all these other ones now?
Right. Yeah. And that's the thing. Whatever government's in power, we got to be reminded that we do as Canadians have the right for that freedom of expression. When those expressions go into the criminal act, they violate the police act, then you can definitely get some sort of response. But really, the call of protest is ultimately two things: to get people on your side for your message and to try to change some sort of government policy. And if you're not effectively delivering those two bits through whatever means or message or public space occupation you're taking, then you're falling short of what really the goals of activism are about. And that's where we can reset ourselves and say, well, look, there's a whole collection of demonstrations going on across the country, around the world, about the events going on in Israel. in Palestine. They're not all the same stripe. There's definitely people out there who are in disagreement with Israel's war in Gaza and very much in disagreement with what happened on October 7th, right? What are those guys asking for? What sort of changes are they asking for? And should we be paying more attention to them too?
Dr. Robert Hewish from Dalhousie University. Always love having you on. Thanks for taking time today.
Thank you so much, Scott. All the best.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
Last week with the federal budget, one of the interesting things, it didn't get a ton of play at the time because there were a lot of things to get into with the federal budget, but one of the things that was dropped in as a little note along the way was an idea of a different kind of mortgage that the federal government says it would be working towards possibly making available. It's going to investigate this. And it's a halal mortgage. It's aimed at Canadian Muslims because of, now, forgive me, Muslims, if I'm not getting this quite right, but my understanding from reading this is that under Islam, they are not supposed to pay interest, so they handle things a little bit differently. It's a different type of loan. If I've got that wrong, I apologize. That's my understanding. The question, though, is this a really good idea that opens the opportunity for people who are of a different faith to be able to buy a home in this country? Or is it a dangerous thing, not that they're Muslim, but that we are creating a two-tier or two levels or a different kind of banking system, basically, depending on what your religion or nationality is? I want to bring in Ian Lee. He is an associate professor with the Sprott School of Business at Carleton University. And I do listen when we have him on here. As I recall, he is also a man who used to be a banker for a number of years and dealt with mortgages a lot. So he's a perfect guy. Ian, thanks for doing this today.
My pleasure, Scott. And you are right. I was in banking for 9 years. I lent millions and millions and millions of dollars in mortgages to individuals and to businesses, commercial mortgages. Before I went back to school and then became a professor. So I'm quite familiar with the mortgage industry in Canada.
So when we look at something like this, there's certainly two ways, maybe more than two ways, but two ways to look at this. One is this is simply another alternative that allows Canadians to get into the housing market. It's a difficult market right now for sure, and it's just simply accommodating different beliefs. The other is, okay, but if you do this, what other accommodations do you have to make for everyone else, or is this playing favors? Where do you fall on this?
This is my concern. I've read up as much as I could. I'm somewhat familiar with halal mortgages. I certainly never made any. I was in the banking business in the 70s and 80s. There was never any request made to me. My concern, and I'm not a religious scholar, I assure you, I am not a scholar of religion. I know that what are called the Abrahamic religions, which is Muslim and the Judaic religion, ban the payment of interest. And I certainly don't challenge that or want to even debate that. I do not challenge any religious, the views of any religion. So I'm speaking as a former banker and someone who teaches strategy and public policy. I think we have to be very careful, because we are increasingly publicly, officially a secular country. Secular meaning we do our best for the government laws and policies and regulations do not favor or give favor or advantage to one religion versus another. We try to be scrupulously neutral. And the charter has been very effective, and the courts have been very effective at moving in that direction. So I'm giving you a nuanced answer. On the one hand, if there are deep embedded, I'm not aware of them, but apparently I've read that there are some possible discriminations of the way the transactions are handled in setting up or establishing halal mortgages. If indeed there is some kind of discrimination in the process, that can be dealt with just because there is a principle that the law should affect everybody equally, that there is a level playing field. That doesn't require, I don't think, quote, establishment of halal mortgages. But when we set it up or are in the process of establishing a mortgage that is very clearly classified as a mortgage for one religious faith, the problem is this. For those who say, well, what's the big deal? What's the problem? The problem isn't with this request. The problem is if another group comes along and says, okay, you set the precedent for that requests from that religion. I'm over here and I'm from another religion and I have my own requests that I want you to embed in the Bank Act or in the mortgage laws or some other law of Canada. And so, as I said, I think we have to be extremely careful that we are not establishing any laws or regulations that have the effect of only benefiting one particular religious group because of the belief in the level playing field. So that whatever laws we do pass should apply to everybody equally, and that they're, it's not giving one advantage to one group versus another. I think that's the risk here, is the risk of setting a precedent that we don't understand the consequences from. That is to say, there are, could be unintended consequences from this down the road.
Well, and I mean, I would think that, and again, I would share that concern, is that it doesn't necessarily even have to be a religious group then. What if it was a racial group, or what if it was some other group of any group
exactly.
that would say exactly. we need this special consideration? And again, I'm with you. It's not about not wanting Muslim people to own homes, and exactly. frankly, I don't. I mean, has that been, I don't even know. Maybe someone will be able to tell me if that's been a real issue. I know many Muslim people and they own homes, so I don't know how they've done that without this, but it just seems like we're opening the door to say, okay, every group then who has a different issue must be accommodated. That becomes very difficult, I would think, for the government and for the banks.
Yes. In fact, let's use the word that we use today, at least in the universities, we use this word all the time, identity groups. And identity politics, which has been discussed ad nauseum in op-eds upon top of op-eds in Canada and the United States for the last 10 years or so, has almost taken over the discourse. You know, it's pushed aside, quote, traditional liberalism, end quote. And I'm talking small L liberalism. I'm not referring to the Liberal Party of Canada. And so identity groups, you know, that I'm of this identity versus that identity, you know, I'm a radical feminist lesbian, and so I require certain privileges that are not available to others. And there's nothing wrong with making that claim. I'm not suggesting that anybody that I'm not suggesting identity groups cannot make the claim. What we have to be very careful, I think, is of agreeing at the public policy and the level of establishing laws in Canada that express the public policy of providing a differential and preferential benefit to one identity group over other identity groups. That's the issue. This actually is not about, quote, halal mortgages, end quote. As you said, I know for a fact that there are Muslim people who have homes and mortgages. I know there are Muslim lenders that provide halal mortgages. So I know that already the market has responded. They may be facing some barriers that I am not privy to because I'm not that technically versed in the intricacies of a halal mortgage. There may be some technical issues. I can't see them on the top. I mean, I know the basic concept of a mortgage, okay? A sum of money is advanced to somebody else to buy a house. And yes, you can disguise the interest. I've done it. We did it with conditional sales contracts where the interest was folded into the principal and then it was written up as a repayment. And I understand that the halal mortgages have a version similar to what once upon a time we called conditional sales contracts in the 70s and 80s in Canada before they were transformed legally into what are now called security interests. So there was such a creature. So again, my point is, big picture takeaway, this is not about whether Muslims should be able to buy properties or not. Of course they should, no question about it. And of course they should have the same opportunity as anybody else. The issue is we have to be very, very careful when we start allowing any identity group to have their demands embedded in the legal system at the that privilege only their identity group and not other identity groups.
Ian Lee, Associate Professor at the Sprott School of Business at Carleton University. Always appreciate you coming on. Thank you for doing this today.
My pleasure, Scott. Thank you.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
My guest for this hour, his name is Steve Foxcroft. He is He is an NBA referee supervisor. He is a referee in his own right. He comes from a long line of sporting Foxcrofts. How are you, sir?
I'm great. It's good to be here. Pinch hitting again for Don Robertson. Yep. That's my role. I get it. That's I understand okay. the role. You know, Don had me cracked up, and I actually repeated it. I was away last week with the boys. The boys and I went away. And I heard Don on with Bubba on his podcast, where you're one of only a couple of two-timers on
there. I'm trying to get to the five-time club so I get the jacket.
Yeah, exactly. Well, Don was on with Bubba promoting what he's doing now, coaching and hopefully winning. And he had the best line when he said he was trying to get Rod Black and Rick Five to commentate.
Which they are for the final. Yeah,
which was great. But the way he presented it to Bubba was outstanding, where he goes, I'm going to give Rod Black the opportunity to say no to me. Which, it was like, that's how I feel today. Scott Radley reached out and gave me the opportunity to say no, and I can't.
And there's lots of people do say no. But by the way, Steve Foxcroft also, because I can't forget this, also a broadcaster and a host of a variety of shows, and Burlington's four-time Mr. Effervescent.
That's it. It keeps coming. The
Santa Claus Parade on Burlington Cable, and that is the word. They keep bringing back effervescent. I don't know where that started. I don't know where it's going, but it's. I'll tell you who is not effervescent right now, Steve Foxcroft. And the game has just faced off the Leafs and the Bruins. And, you know, I was watching. Have you seen the series Welcome to Wrexham?
No.
Okay, so it's a fantastic series. If people haven't seen it, it's on Disney Plus. It's with Ryan Reynolds, the actor.
Oh, love him.
And Rob McElhenney, who was in It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. They're buddies. They bought a fifth division professional Welsh soccer team called Wrexham FC that was in this dilapidated stadium in this rundown town that was hard on its luck. And they bought this team, and they've poured money and effort and everything to try and build this team up and get it promoted and so on. I'm not going to give away anything that actually happens. It's a terrific show. People are looking to watch it. But the reason I mention this is in the episode I was just watching, there was a tough break for the team, and one of the people in town says, when is it our turn? When do we ever get to win something? And I was listening to that, and I thought, I'm sure there are various fan bases around that can offer those words. When's it our turn? When do we finally get to win? But it seemed like that was the line, the motto, the mantra for Leaf fans. And I feel badly for every Leaf fan, because I don't believe, I give the Leafs 1% chance of winning this series. I just don't believe that they're going to do it. I don't. And I look at this, think you've got generational talent on your team, and you're not going to do it. When is it their turn? Have you ever gotten to the point with a team that you like where you've said, it's just not worth it anymore, it hurts too much?
That's a great question. As you know, I'm a Bills fan, four Super Bowls. But when you get there, same with the Buffalo Sabres, who got a new coach today, Lindy Ruff is back. New old coach, so...
And by the way, just let me interrupt for a second. Mm-hmm. People who are calling for the quiz question, bear with us. We're getting to you as fast as we can. I see there's some lines lit up, and we're not getting it right there. So just hang with us or call right back if we don't get it. Anyway, carry on.
It's probably Don Robertson who keeps calling in from behind the bench with the answer. Yeah. So, but like, at least you got – like part of it is you may not win, but you got to get there too. So the Bills have gotten there. My Sabres have gotten there.
To the finals, yeah.
Yeah, so that's got to appease you for a while. But the Leafs – really, other than the Doug Gilmore year, you know, that.
And that was only the semifinals.
Yeah, and Gretzky and the whole Carey Fraser, all that. So they haven't got there. So I feel bad for Leaf fans. There's some other sad sack teams, though, out there. Like, I think right now the Oakland A's, like, not only they don't win, you got to go back to Rolly Fingers
since then, because they had McGuire and Canseco and Dave Stewart and
Moneyball. Moneyball time. So they did okay.
They've had good teams. Again, not but a lot of championships.
Dave Stewart was a long time ago, too.
Well, because he pitched for the Jays in 93.
After he was there. And that was, 93. So you and I are showing our age a little bit. But now they even lose their team, too. So that's just brutal as a fan, too. So the Leafs are right up there right now. And I'm like you. I probably give them a less than 1% chance.
Well, you
got to
I figure, okay, you can't say zero. It's not 0%. But watching them play on the weekend, they looked scared. They looked like the moment was already too big. They looked, anyway, you know, it's funny because I have a friend who is a diehard lifelong Leaf fan, diehard, has spent money to go to games that, you know, it's too expensive and all the rest of stuff, but just diehard. Anyway, and I was talking to him on the weekend. I said, you know, I just mentioned the game. He goes, didn't watch. I cannot, why am I going to just watch to just be disappointed again?
Wow. And that's big.
But I think that, like, I got to believe there are others saying the same thing, if not for game one, because maybe you go into it with optimism that somehow it's going to change. You know, one of the striking things about the Leafs and the Bruins, they have played now five times this year. The Leafs have not led for 1 second. Not 1 second have they had a lead. And you just, I was wishing, because I mean, I'm not covering this series, I'm not covering the Leafs, but I wish one reporter would ask Sheldon Keefe when he's at the podium, what is the one thing that actually makes you believe you can beat the Bruins? Because there is literally no metric, no historic precedent. They haven't won a series over the Bruins since 1959. Yeah. What is, based on what do you truly believe you can win this series? Because I don't see it.
I don't see it either. And I have two questions for you. Do they have to score first tonight? That's the first question. And that would kill the haven't led in five games. And is it a must-win game? Those are my two questions for you.
Yes, it's a must-win game. You're not going to beat Boston four times in five games. That's what you would have to do if you lose tonight. So, yes. And if you lose again, it's just even more in your head. And then you come home, and you know what would happen? You get down at home. Now the home crowd is booing you, and they're on you, and it just gets worse. I don't want to be Mr. Negative, and we'll, you know, keep you updated if anything happens, but I truly believe that this is the last phase of the Brendan Shanahan era, of the Sheldon Keefe era, of probably Mitch Marner. I think you would move on from him at some point if you could.
I hope so. I really do. He's not a playoff body.
He put up a lot of points last year in the playoffs. He put up a lot of points, but they were a lot of sort of second assists and stuff. But
And at time when games were decided and so on, and maybe a little bit on the power play. And right now, I think they'd take something like that.
But well, sure they would.
They have to. But also, what about this then? If they lose close tonight, like if it's overtime and it goes off a leg and in,
I still think that's even worse at this point, because now you lost big, you lost what we just can't beat them.
Right.
We just can't beat them. There's no way to do it. So let me go back to the question, though. Is there ever a point at which cheering for a team becomes just too pain? It's not worth the payoff. The potential payoff is not worth the expected pain.
It's almost like professional wrestling, how they set it up, like the old Cowboys and Indians, and bad guy, bad guy, bad guy, bad guy. But the good guy always wins in the end in professional wrestling, like at WrestleMania. At some point, they're going to win.
At some point, he'll
win. But in this case, you don't have that. You aren't going to get that payoff, right? So you have to wonder to yourself, is it too painful? Is it too emotional? Are you too invested in it? And I think that's why they have drafts the way they do. And you know, teams are... Because you know what's funny, eh? You get good again, and you end up playing the same teams.
Yeah.
Like, teams go away for a decade or so, and then when it comes back around, you're playing the same teams again. You know, it was like that with the Jays. They had the Royals. And then back when Josh Donaldson and all that, who were they playing? The stinking Royals.
Yeah, again. Dan Quisenberry and Brett Saberhagen and those guys. Yeah, no, it's
like, and so you kind of, that's why they set it up like that, though, to hopefully give everybody a chance.
I mean, one of the funny things is when I was watching this series, and again, welcome to Wrexham. It's a terrific series. Like, it's really well done. Even if you don't love soccer, I mean, I'm not a huge soccer fan. It's a show about soccer in the same way that Field of Dreams is about baseball. It's like, that's the setting, but it's not, it's about the people.
Kind of like Quarterback in Netflix, where they did the quarterback.
It's about people.
Yeah, they played quarterback. Yeah. But all of it was off the field kind of stuff.
But I found it so interesting that they said in this, they have waited 15 long years to try and fight back to get promoted up to the next division. I'm like, 15 years. I mean, the Leafs are 56. I hate to say it. This year will be the one quarter of a century mark for the Hamilton Ticats.
I was just going to say that. Like
15 years?
Yeah.
That's almost nothing. I mean, I know you've made a good Hollywood show about this, and you've drummed it up about how horrible life has been, but you don't know nothing.
15 years is nothing.
15
yeah,
years that's is like an appetizer. A, yeah, that's just clearing your throat.
Like Leaf fans right now would buy into that. Ticat fans would do the same. And even me, Sabre fans, 13 years.
Well,
like,
but I mean, not just 13 years. Forever.
Well, forever. Not forever.
And Bills fans,
yeah,
forever.
Yeah, forever.
You know, I would argue that Buffalo fans, even more than Leaf fans, get to say, when's it our turn?
Right.
That they, and the way their teams have,
that's
you know,
what it is.
Toe in the crease and all the Super Bowl, like it just, I am convinced that Buffalo is some sort of cosmic experiment in torturing its citizens to see how much they can take.
Because like I said at the start, they get there. You know, that you think that would appease you, but then Buffalo goes one step further and just does it even this year with Kansas City, a field goal that should be decent, like, you know, should have went in. And they wide right.
Music City Miracle, 13 seconds. You can go down the list. I wrote this a while back. Buffalo, it's so bad in Buffalo that you've got names of all of your torturous moments. At least in Toronto, you know, they've got 4-1, which was the lead over the Bruins when they blew that. Okay, 4-1, and you've got 67. But Buffalo, like, it is toe in the crease, Music City Miracle, wide right, 13 seconds. What am I forgetting? There's a bunch of other ones, on and on and on. They just, it's remarkable how Buffalo has been tormented. But honestly, I'm almost getting to the point, and I really hope that, you know, this year, maybe now that the Ticats don't have the pressure of hosting a Grey Cup and they can, I don't know if that makes anybody relax. I don't know if that helps, but that, you know, maybe this is the year they can finally snap out of it and figure it out.
Well, we got a quarterback that hopefully can be healthy.
Hopefully. Yeah. Hopefully.
A coach, a head coach that I kind of like. I kind of like him. I think he's going to.
I know, but I do recall that we would have said the same thing when Kent Austin took over, and we would have said the same thing when Orlando Steinauer took over. We have said, "Oh, we've got the guy now."
Right.
We got so I look. I don't disagree about Scott Milanovich. I think he's a really good coach. But this is a story that we have repeated a few times, and it's never turned out with a different result.
Yeah, we gotta stay healthy at the quarterback spot. I think would help us tremendously.
Well, even if. You know, they start training camp in 3 weeks, I think.
Yeah.
Mother's Day. Why do they start training? I started on Mother's Day, right? But even if Bo Levi Mitchell stays healthy, I think the real intrigue of this year is what is Bo Levi Mitchell at this point? If he stays healthy, can he be the guy that we remember in Calgary, or is he the Bo Levi Mitchell that now lost his job there and is a backup and really is? I don't know. I don't think anyone knows.
And that's the caveat when I say we got to stay healthy at the quarterback position, because he's got to be like he was for glimpses last year when he finally got in the lineup. He had a live arm, I thought, at times last year.
Yeah, he actually overthrew a few guys in some of those
like
games.
He was throwing darts, but it just wasn't consistent enough. And then what they did in the playoffs, I just don't understand where, you know, it's like that old one, you're down 63-0 and you put the guy in, he goes, you want to win or tie? Yeah. Like, it was kind of like that. Like,
he went in with, 8 minutes left or something? And it was like, come on, it's not even, anyway.
What he said afterwards was kind of true. Like, how can I be back when this is how they treat me? I'm, you know, the highest paid guy and so on and so forth. And I didn't even start and so on. But anyway, that's all last year. There's been enough changes. And if he stays healthy and can be a good CFL quarterback, which he's got to be, because even if he's healthy, if he's not, then Scott has to do something about that.
I think he has to be more than a good CFL quarterback. I think he has to be a great CFL quarterback. I don't think that who's the last team in the league to win without one of the top two or three performing quarterbacks?
I think, it doesn't happen in the CFL. It happens in the NFL every maybe decade, 12, 15 years.
Yeah, but you have an unbelievable offensive line and a defense that just locks everything down and you can get away with an Elvis Gerback.
Doesn't happen in the CFL.
Not
you
often.
Need that.
Not often.
You know? So we'll have to see, but I'm excited for that, but he has to be the guy, like you said, healthy and the former, like the real Bo Levi.
I mean, they signed him for good money. Now, he took, and I credited him, and I do credit him with, he reworked his contract mm-hmm. a little bit and allowed for some, you know, his contract to be redone so that you could bring in some other guys. I think that's a smart thing to do because, look, at this point, if I'm Bo Levi Mitchell, surely at this point, I not only want my money, but I want my legacy. And right. I think that his legacy is reasonably well established in this league, but to go to another team and win again.
Yes.
Now it's not, oh, you were just with a great team in Calgary. Right. Now you just didn't have a great coach. Now you went somewhere. Those guys that can do that, man, that is a special thing.
And so I'll throw two names quickly out at you. Danny McManus and Mike Carrigan.
Mm-hmm.
Like, Mike maybe not with someone else, but Danny Mac won two places. So I think he was just rubber stamp greatest, like, great. And I loved Mike Carrigan, too, when he was here. He was great. But he didn't go anywhere else and do it, as far as I can
Flutie.
Recall.
Flutie was Cal. He was, yeah. Wasn't he BC first, then Calgary?
Yeah,
then
Toronto. Yeah.
You know.
I'm talking more Ticats, though, because Flutie never.
Oh, sure,
like,
sure.
So that's my Ticat guys like that, was Mike Carrigan and Danny Mac.
Yeah, you're not putting Timmy Chang in that group?
I'm going to leave him out for now. Danny Mac, just a Danny Mac sighting last week, by the way.
Is that right?
Because he lives in the survey across the street down in Florida, and we went to where the Atlanta Braves play. They have a brand new stadium in Northport. Who's there? Danny Mac.
Scouting?
I think his kid might have been playing or something. We were at the baseball stadium. They have a nice restaurant there. And there was a couple high school games or like youth league games going on. And he just ran into him. Now, Danny Mac, too, let's say this. He looks like when you see him on the street, even when he played, you didn't think he was a CFL quarterback.
Danny Mac was never built like an Adonis.
That's right.
Like, he was more... He's going to kill me. He was more built like a Barba Papa for those old enough to remember.
That's
like,
right.
He was a guy who had some, he was able to take a hit with some extra padding.
Yes, exactly.
But he could play.
Yeah.
He couldn't run out of the pocket. He couldn't run, but he could throw. He could get rid of the ball in a second and he could find a receiver and he could hit the target and he could play. And look, if Danny Mac was in his prime, and again, his prime was never, he was never Josh Allen.
Yeah.
But if he was in his prime, I would take that
his
every
release,
day of the
week. You
mentioned
it. His release was the quickest I can remember. He got rid of the ball so quick. And I think his lifetime career stats was one carry, 12 yards.
Something like that. Something and I think like he pulled a hamstring doing it. But there was one year that I remember, and I don't know what year it was. It was early in his time in Hamilton that I believe the team set a record by allowing the fewest sacks. He got sacked like four times because he just got rid of the ball so darn fast.
Exactly.
But I go back to my point. So Danny Mac, you know, we come full circle here. He was the QB in 99 last time Hamilton won. I don't know if that long drought of no Grey Cups has cut into the fan base. I don't know if the lack of success, I don't know if winning... If they had won five Grey Cups in the meantime, would you have more fans of the team? Maybe. But the fact that you haven't won, does it mean you have less fans of the team?
Yeah.
I don't know.
That's a good
question. I don't know. Have people tuned out because they've just gotten to the point, like a lot of Leaf fans, I'm guessing, who are just like, it's just not worth it. I can't take getting excited for a game and then getting disappointed.
Yeah, that's a tough thing that it's hard to measure. I think it's a hard sell nowadays for the Tiger Cats. It's a tough business, I think, to be in any sports entertainment and stuff like that because of all the other things going on. There's so much, like, let's face it, growing up, the Tiger Cats were the only game in town.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was an easy sell. And when Stelco and DeFasco were, you know, 16,000 people employed and so on and so forth. That was what Hamilton was. Like the Ticats and Steeltown and everything, it was an easy sell.
Well, now, that team was tied up in the emotional whatever of the city.
Almost, yeah.
And you know, we started this whole thing with that show about Wrexham, Welcome to Wrexham, about the soccer team. And it's amazing how, you know, that is exactly what this is. Like that team, when it wins, that city is up.
Right.
And when it loses, everyone is feeling it. And I don't know if that's the same now with the Ticats, that if the Ticats lose, that everyone in town is down or vice versa. I don't know.
I think it helps it I think it's just you always have your core fans, right? Yep. And they come out all the time, and they just get sour when we lose and how we lose, but they don't leave, right? They're still there, but they're sour to it.
And we'll take a break as the Bruins go up 1-0 to maintain the string of being behind in this series.
And like Leafs give up a power play, right? They score on the power play. Like, you can't do that. Can't take penalties.
Steve, you, as everyone knows, come from a long line of refereeing and officiating Foxcrofts. You are NFL chain crew guy. You work with the NBA officiating referees. There is so much that we're just into the baseball season, and there is already so much stuff about umpires, especially one in particular. Guy named Angel Hernandez, who every time he goes behind home plate, Twitter goes berserk because he seems to, let's put it this way, he is everyone's idea of the worst umpire in the world, and he seems to live up to that with some regularity. He misses call, and here's the thing, I don't know, every umpire is going to miss some calls. Maybe it's just that they're picking him out and looking especially hard at him, but he doesn't help his cause sometimes.
He's like, remember when the San Diego Chicken came out with the eye chart once in a while, and he had the best comedy show ever of any mascot. He was the king of it. London, Ontario guy.
Is that right?
Yeah, okay. Ted Gionis, I believe, from London, Ontario. But Angel, I think he's either nearsighted or farsighted. I really do think he has a vision problem, because it's like when he gets close, and like he misses calls, to your point, everyone's going to miss a couple behind the dish, right? But he's consistently bad. And it's not just one or two teams he's annoyed.
No, every team seems to not like him. And like every fan base.
He's the guy. He's the ugly duckling of the referee or the umpires.
And so do you think that is, whether it's fair or not, do you think that it's just in officiating, do guys get a reputation and then no matter what happens, they will never be able to shake it? You could go 25 games in a row being perfect, but the 26th game, you miss one call and it's, oh, there's Angel Hernandez again. Like, look, I'm not defending the guy, because I think he, you know, you see enough calls that are goofy. But it does seem like, man, no one else seems to get the kind of scrutiny that he does.
Because he's consistently inconsistent, right? And because here's a good example of one, I think, that, because this came up again when I'm away with the boys. Jim Joyce, when the Tigers, Galarraga, is that how you say it? He had the perfect game, and Jim Joyce just blew it.
Yeah.
But that was really the only one that Jim Joyce,
And then he came out the next day in tears.
Yes.
Apologized, not even that, later that day, and then the next day in tears for blowing the goal. You never see remorse or I'm sorry or contrition or anything.
And every ref wants to be perfect and then improve, right? So with him, he came out the next day, and I think Galarraga brought the lineup card out, and they kind of embraced a little bit, and like you said, he apologized and everything. So right away, you've diffused everything.
Yeah, I'm human, I blew it.
Yeah.
And I acknowledge it.
But Angel Hernandez blows it every night and doesn't apologize, and he just keeps getting every fan base annoyed. Like, at the start of every game, like, thankfully he's only behind the dish once every, like, 4 or 5 days and so on and so forth. But that kind of, the Jim Joyce thing and admitting your mistakes is, I think, the best way to go, because it diffuses things. Like, if I'm refereeing basketball, football, whatever it is, and a coach comes at me, and you can diffuse it by saying, the way you say it happened, if it happened that way, then I missed it.
Mm-hmm.
But then you could then follow up with, but I saw it differently. And right away, it kind of diffuses it a bit, rather than just saying, no, I'm right, and off we go. And I think Tom Brady should have done that with Deflategate. Like, he should have said, yeah, I told the guy to keep the ball soft, but I didn't tell him to keep them so soft they were illegal. And that all would have went away.
Yeah, maybe. You know? Maybe. Depends how the guy then would have
Sorry. Tom said he likes playing the balls to be a little soft. Like, because it does say inflate to like 7 to 9 pounds, whatever it is. So 6.5 is soft. And, you know, you could have got away with it. And just Tom Brady, say that you told the guy, I want him soft.
There was another umpiring situation today. And this is what I find. I just find it so... I think we live in a time when because of 4K TV and because every game is televised and there's social media and everything, I think that umpires, officials in general, have more scrutiny than ever before. But also I wonder if that doesn't mean if you're an official, you have to have more, less elephant ears. And because the story here was Aaron Boone, the manager of the Yankees, somebody was yelling something from behind the dugout. The umpire warned him, and then it was a fan, and the fan yelled something again, and Aaron Boone got tossed out of the game. He goes, I didn't even say anything.
Right.
And the umpire is like, no, you're out. And it's like, you know what? If you know that there is this level of scrutiny and ability to see stuff, you'd better be right.
I agree
with
that.
You'd better be. And if you're not sure, you go, I just have to live with it until I see him do it, and then I'm...
Because that's when you would go over, in my opinion, you'd go over between innings and just say, Aaron, look, you're like whatever you're saying, stop it.
Yeah.
And then he'll tell you right then, but it's not me, Steve. Scott, it's not me.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you have at least addressed it and, you know, give Aaron a chance. But to just arbitrarily assume.
Because a fan yells something and you assume.
And fans are going to be like that. Like
The other thing, and I've never understood this about sports officials, and it's certainly not all sports officials. It's a very small number, quite honestly, but I've never understood the hair temper fuse on some. If you go into this, now I am not of the opinion that you should go into this just to be abused.
Right.
I don't believe that that's the place of an umpire or a ref, or especially at kids, whatever, but your job is not to be abused. But I also don't think that you should expect that you're going to be treated like the Pope at all times. Sometimes, you know what? People are going to yell at you. Okay.
Part of the job.
Okay.
Yep.
You know what? He yelled at me. He called me a name. You've been called a name. I've been called a name. I don't. When people send me an email saying your column was stupid and blah, 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 I don't write back and go, you're a so-and-so. It's like, okay, well, you know what? Thanks for sharing your opinion.
Yeah.
As
Don Robertson would say, thanks for telling me no.
Yeah.
You know, you have the opportunity.
I don't understand the, I don't know if it's just such a, if the fuse is low because it's become such a difficult job now that everyone's on edge.
Well, there's certain refs that have the reputation for it too, right? If you're a coach or a player, you know, let's use the NBA as an example or the NHL playoffs, you know what refs you can go up to and maybe, you know, be a little
push
more
a little,
in their face, right? But there's some, I've seen it in the NBA especially, there's maybe three where you do not challenge anything. Like, it's just done, over with, technical foul, gone, right? And it happens. So it's like, I guess, in regular walks of life, you deal with all types of different people.
I just think that if I'm an official, knowing what the technology is that exists now in a lot of sports, especially if you're a home, if you're in a baseball umpire, you could you could literally umpire a game now mechanically.
Correct.
And you, home plate, bases, everything. You do not technically need men or women on the field umpiring. You could do this game entirely by camera and computer. I don't know that I want to be creating a scenario where I make myself the show and look like, if I'm baseball, you know, maybe we don't need this anymore.
I always say to my refs when I was in charge, when I was a supervisor of officials, just be right. Like, don't ref how, like, it should have been or anything like that, because video proves it right. So just be right, because there's always video that will verify it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also video that will verify when you're wrong. So just be right.
Be right. You know? And I would throw in another word, and be humble.
And be humble.
You don't, like, you brought a great example of Jim Joyce. You know what? You're going to make mistakes. And you could say this better. Not that you make a lot of mistakes. I'm not saying that. But as a guy who's been in the officiating game, you're going to make mistakes. You're a human being. If you are the one who pretends that I cannot be called on it because I never make a mistake, that only makes you, to me, that only makes you look like a buffoon when you are wrong.
Right. And I think it's all about the initial approach, too. Like, there's some players, coaches, fans, whatever, they immediately go off. But if you approach me in more of a conversation, like, Steve, I think you really missed that one, or Steve, can you watch for this, or Steve, that didn't happen, or whatever, then it gives me the opportunity to say, if it happened the way you say it did, I missed it, and so on and so forth. But if you immediately come at me swearing and cussing and saying I'm the worst thing, because I do get a lot of them right. Like, a lot of the calls are easy, right? 97% are going to be right.
Yeah.
3% bear with us, right? And deal with the 3% that are close and so on. But here's a question for you. Do you like the strike box in when you're watching a baseball game? Do you like having it there? Yeah,
yes,
on TV.
I do because the angle that the camera is never directly behind the pitcher because you can't see through the pitcher.
You wouldn't see.
It has to be off to the side a little bit. So I think it's that strike zone box gives you a sense of and honestly, it would be weird to watch a game without it.
So if when the ball catches some of the strike zone, like the square box is in there, and the ball catches it, like one quarter of the ball hits the line at the top, bottom side, or whatever, is that a strike?
Yes, of course.
It doesn't have to be.
It.
Yeah, it touches
as long as it.
Touches.
So, and I am perpetually amazed, and I've thought this many times, I am perpetually amazed at how often they get it right. Like the ball is 2 inches off the plate, and they call it a ball, and it's correct. And I'm...
Because those
so
are the
often.
Ones where it catches the line a bit. Those are the ones that are 50-50, I guess, where you kind of say, okay, it's a strike, but it's right on the edge, maybe high-low. So you give them a little bit more of the benefit of the doubt. But to your point, the good ones are pretty good.
They are
and
great.
Consistent.
It's when it's 6 inches off the plate.
And they're calling it a strike or something. Yeah. Now, I'll give you the number one question I get when we take people to Bills games. So I'm on the field, get back to the car, we're driving home.
Yes.
The number one question I get, where's the yellow line on the field for them to get a first down? So we're talking about the strike box, the yellow line for them to get to the first down. Where is it?
Give it time. Eventually, they will figure out a way to project that onto the field, and it'll be there. Except in the winter of the Bills game, it'll now look like a big line of pee in the snow.
Exactly.
We got just a few minutes left here with Steve Foxcroft. And Steve, this week we learned that Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is one of the finalists, Hamilton guy, one of the finalists for the NBA's Most Valuable Player, along with Luka Doncic and Nikola Jokic. And I don't know if he's going to win or not, but if he did, has there ever been a Hamiltonian that would have won a bigger, more prestigious award? I can't think of it.
No, not even close. First of all, Shai, second best player out of McNabb High School, because you know I went to McNabb High School. That's my line, and I'm sticking to it.
And I you know, that's written on the wall. They have a stencil there.
Exactly. Best ref out of McNabb High School. That's all I'm going to say there.
I can't think that there'd be anybody.
The closest we could be is if we claim Gretzky because he grew up in Brantford. That's the closest we could be ever.
I mean, I was thinking Harry Howell, who won the Norris Trophy, but that's the Norris Trophy. That's not MVP of the league. That was a huge thing.
Big deal. And he had a long career. He was great. But I don't think you could touch that with a Hamiltonian at that level and a world stage.
And even like Dave Andrechuk winning the cup and have a statue in front of him in the Tampa Arena. But that was a team thing. And at that time in his career, he was a fourth line guy.
He was like the Ray Bourque guy getting it with Colorado instead of Boston.
Yeah.
So, no, you're naming great Hamiltonians. You're naming great Hamiltonians that way, right? And there's a whole long list that you talk about every year at the Hamilton Sports Hall of Fame with Gary McKay. But to that level, because really – you got to expand it to Canada because Steve Nash is the only guy that's even close. Like Shai, they're already comparing Shai to, you know, is he Steve Nash like or whatever? Steve Nash won two MVPs back to back. But you're just narrowing it down to Hamilton rather than Canada. I don't think like it would be close. You've named two great ones.
All right, so the only other ones that possibly come to mind, and it's not an award per se, is how does winning a PGA Tour event, so Mackenzie Hughes, how does that compare? He's won two. That's an individual thing.
A major like a Mike Weir, you know, then Brights Grove, then I think it's elevated, and I would put it right up there.
You know,
like if Mackenzie Hughes won a major, that would be out of control.
That would. And I mean, you probably could put in the discussion anyway, Sarah Nurse, who set a record for most points in an Olympics, but that's a 1 week or week and a half long event, which doesn't take anything away from it, but it's not the same as NBA MVP. It just isn't.
It isn't. And And right now, too, like when Steve Nash won the MVP, it was like there wasn't anybody else. Like
he ran away.
Yeah, he ran away with it because there was no Shaq or anybody else. With Shea right now, it's a deep pool.
We will see. Steve Foxtrot, thanks for coming
in
today.
Great being here.
The Scott Radley Show. Weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.